This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Psalms. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in Psalms chapter 45 with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
He says, "You are my king, O God. Command victories for Jacob." And I love this next line. "Through you, we will push down our enemies. Through your name, we trample those who rise up against us." And he said, when we needed it, God gave us that push. He gave us that push. Has God ever given you a push when you needed it? Just fired you up, just gave you that little nudge right when you needed it. Verse 6, "I will not trust in my bow, nor shall my sword save me. But you have saved us from our enemies and have put to shame those who hated us. In God we boast all day long and praise your name forever." Pause and think about that. You want to boast, you can boast all day long if it's in God that you boast. In God we boast all day long. "But you have cast us off and put us to shame, and you do not go out with our armies. You make us turn back from the enemy, and those who hate us have taken spoil for themselves. You have given us up like sheep intended for food and have scattered us among the nations. You sell your people for next to nothing and are not enriched by selling them. You make us a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and a derision to those all around us. You make us a byword among the nations, a shaking of the head among the peoples." My, this psalm has taken a turn. God says, yes, you delivered us in times past, but you've also brought judgment on us when we've needed it. You know, Psalm 44 is thought to have been written during the days of King Hezekiah. The Assyrian general Sennacherib had just conquered the northern 10 tribes of Israel and had now laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. And Sennacherib had sent his propagandists to speak to Jerusalem in Hebrew, in their native tongue. And what did they do? They mocked Hezekiah, and they mocked his God, and they mocked his faith. Their strategy was to strike fear in the hearts of Israel and intimidate them into a surrender without a battle. The psalmist continues, "My dishonor is continually before me, and the shame of my face has covered me because of the voice of him who reproaches and reviles." That was Sennacherib's messengers. "Because of the enemy and the avenger." You see, what was confusing to the psalmist is that this challenge had come on the heels of a great revival. Remember, Hezekiah and his friend Isaiah had instituted a series of reforms that renewed the nation's faith and returned them to God. And the psalmist here is expressing his frustration. He says, "All this has come upon us, but we have not forgotten you, nor have we dealt falsely with your covenant. Our heart has not turned back, nor have our steps departed from your way. But you have severely broken us in the place of jackals and covered us with the shadow of death. If we had forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to a foreign God, would not God search this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart." You see, the psalmist is confused. If the nation had been sinning, then he could have interpreted this invasion as God's judgment, a righteous judgment. But this enemy didn't show up until after the people had turned their hearts back to God. Why are they suffering now? Good question. You know, I hear this complaint a lot from Christians. "Man, my life was going great until I got saved. And then all of a sudden, things got harder. Things got tougher, man. I started getting persecuted. I started encountering all kinds of new problems. What's with that?" Guys, when you're on the devil's side, why would he waste time attacking you in the first place? You know, it's only when you renounce the devil, it's only when you join God's team that suddenly you become a threat to him. It's suddenly you become a target for his persecution. You become a target for the hassles and hardships he wants to throw at you. This is what was happening to the psalmist. Notice what the psalmist says in verse 22. He says, "Yet for your sake we are killed all day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter." Isn't it interesting? You recognize this verse. Paul quotes it in Romans 8, verse 36. Paul quotes it in the context of recounting the things that he has suffered for the sake of Christ. I hope you know by now, the Christian life is not a bed of roses. God never promised us a smooth path, a trouble-free life. Being a Christian, in fact, includes persecution and hardship. God makes it that way. It's a part of Christian discipleship. There are things that we learn only by going through the furnace. He says, "Awake, why do you sleep, O Lord? Arise, do not cast us off forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust, our body clings to the ground. Arise for our help and redeem us for your mercy's sake." The psalmist saw the presence of trouble as a sign of God's absence, but he was thinking wrongly. Verses 25 and 26 tell us that God allows opposition in our lives for two reasons. It reminds us of our helplessness, and it drives us to God for help. In the long run, battles are really blessings. Well, Psalm 45 is a love song, and it's set to the tune, "The Lilies." Never heard the tune, but I'm sure it was a good one. It may have been a wedding song composed for a royal wedding. It actually speaks of the king and his bride. Now, the identity of the kingly couple in Psalm 45 is unknown. It could have been David and Michael. Perhaps it was Solomon and the Shulamite. Here's the wedding music for their wedding. You read about their honeymoon over in the Song of Solomon. It could have been Hezekiah and Hephzibah, who was the daughter of Isaiah. We know for sure that it speaks of Christ and His bride, the church. Well, verse 1 tells us, "My heart is overflowing with a good theme. I recite my composition concerning the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword upon your thigh, O mighty one, with your glory and your majesty. And in your majesty, ride prosperously because of truth, humility, and righteousness. And your right hand shall teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you." This king is a victor. He's also a sovereign. He says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions." Notice this king is a happy man. God has anointed him with the oil of gladness. I think of my king, Jesus. You know, one of the things that anger me the most is whenever I see Jesus portrayed as sad and as solemn. I believe that Jesus was anointed with the oil of gladness. He had a grin on his face most of the time. Jesus was the glad man, I have no doubt. He smiled and he laughed a lot. Don't you love that picture of Jesus? That's how I picture Jesus in my mind. He was anointed with gladness. And you know, I believe that when I open my eyes for the first time in heaven, I'm going to see a smiling Jesus with a big grin on his face, happy to see me. Well, he continues to describe the king. He says, "All your garments are scented with myrrh and aloes and cassia out of the ivory palaces by which they have made you glad. King's daughters are among your honorable women. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir." Boy, gold. Ophir was a region renowned for its gold. All the purest gold came from Ophir. And here the queen comes into view. He's been talking about the king. Now he starts talking about the queen. And guess what? The queen is wearing some bling. She's decked out in this gold from Ophir. Now here's what's happening. The queen is about to enter the honeymoon chamber. But first, she's told how she needs to prepare for the special night. You know, today when a girl prepares for her wedding night, she starts out by soaking in a tub, And then she hits the salon for a manicure and a pedicure and an updo, whatever that is. I paid for one. I don't know what it is. And then she's moisturized, and then she's accessorized, and then she spends as much of Dad's money as she can. But for this bride, the preparation is all mental. She prepares her heart relationally. You know, I think that's often overlooked when it comes to the intimacy side of marriage. You know, the most important sex organ for both men and women is their brain. You know, it's having the right attitude. It's having a love for one another, a caring and a giving for one another. Sexual intimacy in marriage is more about attitude than it is anatomy. And notice what she's told to prepare her for the wedding night. She's told, "Listen, O daughter, consider and incline your ear. Forget your own people also and your father's house." Now here's what makes a great lover for all you married couples. Four words. Listen, consider, incline, and forget. First, the queen, she listens rather than talks. Second, she considers the king. She thinks of his needs, not her own. She's focused on him, not herself. Third, she inclines, or she leans out, and she sort of stretches her soul out toward him. And then fourth, she forgets home. She puts her past behind her. She stays in the moment, in the present. The queen has the ability to put her past behind it and live in the moment. Now, verse 11 assures the queen of her husband's love. "So the king will greatly desire your beauty because he is your Lord. Worship him." And notice the connection here between sexuality and spirituality. Notice sexual intimacy in marriage is analogous to spiritual intimacy in worship. He's talking about the queen going in to the chambers with the king, and then the final words are, "Worship him." I do believe that what makes a good lover also makes a good worshiper. Intimacy with your spouse is a lot like intimacy with God. Remember those four words: listen, consider, incline, and forget. Here's a great formula for worship. When we worship God, we need to listen, not talk. We need to be attentive. We need to keep from getting distracted or sidetracked. How often do we let a little annoyances break our concentration? John Donne once said, "I neglect God and his angels for the noise of a fly, for the rattling of a coach, for the whining of a door. I neglect God and his angels for a squeaky door." We should consider as well as listen. We need to focus on God's character, not just our needs. If we want to worship, we need to incline or stretch out our soul toward God. You know, you can reach out spiritually to God. You can do that, and you should. And then finally, we need to forget the past. To be a good worshiper, it involves staying in the moment. It involves living in the present. As Paul said to the Philippians, "Forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press toward the mark." Well, notice verse 12. "And the daughter of Tyre will come with a gift. The rich among the people will seek your favor." Here he's talking about the wedding shower. Daughter of Tyre comes with a gift. "And the royal daughter is all glorious within the palace. Her clothing is woven with gold. She shall be brought to the king in robes of many colors. The virgins, her companions who follow her, shall be brought to you with gladness and rejoicing. They shall be brought. They shall enter the king's palace." Now remember, just before he ascended to heaven, Jesus told his disciples that he was going to prepare a place for them. He was following Jewish wedding custom. After the betrothal, the husband would go home and he would prepare an abode for his bride. When it was complete, then he would return for the home taking. That's when he would get her and he would usher her out and bring her back to the place he had prepared for her. For us, that home taking goes by another name. It's called the rapture. As the bride of Christ, we should be looking for. We should be looking for the Lord coming back to take us to be where he's prepared for us to be. Today, Jesus is in heaven. technically we're betrothed to Him. But when that heavenly home is complete, He's promised to return and take us to be where He is and to live with Him forever. Perhaps this is the day Psalm 45 envisions, with gladness and rejoicing they shall be brought, they shall enter the king's palace. I'm looking forward to that day. Verse 16, instead of your fathers shall be your sons, whom you shall make princes in all the earth. I will make your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore the people shall praise you forever and ever. The preface to Psalm 46 calls it a song of Alamoth. The word Alamoth probably means high-pitched. Perhaps this was a song for the sopranos. Not the gangsters, but the sisters in the choir. You know, the high-pitched voices in the choir. Now, most commentators agree that Psalms 46 through 48 were written at the time of this Assyrian assault on Jerusalem that we mentioned earlier. You see, Assyria was a rising empire. Oh, in the middle 7th century B.C., Assyria was a rising empire bent on world conquest. They had overthrown Syria and Israel, and now they were headed toward Egypt. Only Jerusalem and the Jewish king Hezekiah stood in their way. And when Hezekiah looked over the walls, he saw the meanest troops on the planet camped against him in his city. But he prayed, and he had faith, and he trusted God. And he got his buddy Isaiah to pray as well. And a battle angel was sent by God in the middle of the night. And that one battle angel slaughtered 185,000 Assyrian troops in that one night. The next morning, when Hezekiah got up and he looked over the walls, all he saw was carnage and bloodshed and devastation. He couldn't believe it, that God had won this victory, that the troops had been slaughtered by an angel in the middle of the night. They had won the victory without even a fight. And that's when he picked up a pen, and either he or one of the sons of Korah wrote of God's deliverance. He says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The Hebrew word translated trouble means a tight spot. Ever been in a tight spot? I'll bet there are a few here tonight that are in a tight spot. I love Psalm 46. It's how to get out of a tight spot. That's another title for it. I love Psalm 46. Here's an outline for you. You can go back and really dwell on this psalm. It's a great psalm. One of my favorites. In verses 1 through 3, God is a refuge. God is a refuge. In verses 4 through 7, God is a river. And then in verses 8 through 11, God is the ruler. God is a refuge. He's a river. And He's the ruler. Now the psalm begins, God is our refuge. In other words, He's a place of protection from the storm. And life is full of storms, isn't it? Boy, life can flood us. A swirl of activity takes place. Situations overwhelm. Suddenly, we're looking uphill. We were just bowled over. We didn't know what happened to us. Wow, how things can change so quickly. I've heard it put, life is like fighting a gorilla. You don't rest when you get tired. You rest when the gorilla gets tired. And yet God is a refuge. He is a very present help in times of trouble. That expression means He's easily accessible in times of trouble. Aren't you glad? Not a lot of red tape you have to go through to get to God. Not a lot of forms you got to fill out. Aren't you glad that when you pray, somebody on the other end of the line doesn't say, well, if you'd like Jesus, punch one. If you'd like the Holy Spirit, punch two. If you like God, punch three. Aren't you glad it doesn't work like that? That you can just come boldly to the throne of grace, cut through the red tape, just come immediately into God's presence. He is a very present help in trouble. He's our refuge. He's our rock. You know, my daughter was a cheerleader in high school. The best there ever was, by the way. And now she coaches cheerleaders, and she had a favorite cheer. We did it around the house all the time. I still know the words. Rain can't rock this house. Thunder can't rock this house. Lightning can't rock this house. And you can't rock this house. And my daughter was a cheerleader. I wasn't a cheerleader. I was the quarterback. But my daughter was the cheerleader. But this is what the psalmist is saying about God in Psalm 46. He's saying, bring on the storm, man. Bring on the rain. Bring on the thunder. It doesn't matter to me. You can't rock this house because my rock is Jesus Christ. My life is built on a solid rock. God is what we need when we need Him. You remember that when you get in a tight spot, okay? He says, therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed. And a literal translation would read, though the land changes hands. Recall the context here. Invaders are sitting just outside the city gates. And the psalmist is envisioning a worst-case scenario. He's saying, even if the city gets sacked, even if we're invaded and taken over by foreigners, God will still be faithful to His people. His plans for us will not fail. How's that for some real faith? He says, though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling, though all this happens, I'm going to trust in God. Add to his list, though the economy tanks, though I lose my job, though I can't sell my home, though my teenager rebels, God is still my refuge. Who will I fear? You know, real faith, notice he says here, though the mountains be carried away, though the waters roar, though the mountains shake. Notice this, real faith is though faith, not if faith. It's not, I'll trust God if He makes my life easy, if He makes my life safe. It's not that at all. It's though faith, not if faith. It's I'll trust God though hard times come, though difficulties arise. God is a refuge. And God is also a river. Verse 4. There is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. Now, in preparation of a siege against the capital city, King Hezekiah had moved to secure Jerusalem's water supply. The Gihon Spring bubbles up just southeast of the city. Do you see the little walls that jut out right there on the side? On the right, lower right-hand side? That's the Gihon Spring. Later, they built walls around it, but at the time, the water was outside the city, so they had to go outside the walls to get water to take it back into the city. Well, what Hezekiah did in preparation for this invasion, he went and he built a tunnel 1,777 feet long through this solid rock. This tunnel was an amazing feat of ancient engineering. It brought the water up into the city, so the water supply would be in the gates of the city, within the city walls. Therefore, yeah, they'd have access to the water in the event of an invasion. But it not only was it an engineering feat, this spring was also a picture of Judah's relationship with God. For like this spring brought water into the city, likewise God is a river who brings water into our lives. As the Gihon supplied Israel with water, God supplies us with supernatural strength and supernatural refreshment. Notice verse 5. He says, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. I love that verse. God is in the midst. Hey, God is always in the midst of whatever I'm in the middle of. Understand, God's right there with you. He's in the midst of your mess. He's in the midst of whatever you're in the middle of.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. Pastor Sandy comes to us from Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain, located in Atlanta, Georgia. In today's message, Pastor Sandy continued through the Psalms. Whether you find yourself on the mountaintop of life with words of praise and gratitude, or in the valley full of doubt and despair, there is a psalm that offers encouragement. With 150 chapters to choose from, There's something that will lift you up in your time of need or help you express your joy and give God the glory for your gain. The very existence of this book illustrates how devoted the early believers were to their newfound faith in the one true God. If their songs filled 150 chapters then, just think about the number of pages we could fill with all that God has provided since then, and the songs that have been written as praises and also reminders to keep the faith during hard times. To hear more, visit our website, sandyadams.org. Again, that's sandyadams.org. Each time you listen here, Pastor Sandy brings sound biblical teaching as he goes through the Bible book by book, verse by verse. You'll hear the truth and discover more about our Lord and Savior as you do. That's the power of community in Christ. We're so glad you decided to spend your time with us today. Be sure to come back again for more here on Sandy Adams Radio.